The Round with Richard Kaufman. Sunday, the 6th of June, 2010.
With many of the players I sit down with for The Round, I got, I suppose, a preconceived idea of how the story of The Round goes, which isn't surprising as quite a few of them I've actually witnessed. But when Matt Southgate told me he was choosing an amateur event, the St Andrews Links Trophy, I wasn't really sure what I'd get. It turned into a very nice surprise. Matt may be in the infancy of his career, but he's already got many incredible tales to tell. But first, he explained why he chose the St Andrews Links Trophy of 2010.
I just think it was a bit of a game-changer for me career-wise. I'd never won a big tournament. I'd competed a few times, but I was pretty down in the dumps at that stage of my career. I'd sort of been to the States, didn't like that, came home and worked hard. And I was sort of trying to force my way into the English men's team and, you know, try and get in the home internationals and up the world rankings for the amateur game, and I was just firing a blank. I couldn't do anything right. It seemed at that time, and then out of nowhere, I just won the, you know, one of the biggest stroke play amateur events in the world by 5 shots, and it was a bit unexpected. So I think it just sort of propelled me to go on to bigger and better things.
So you're 21 years old at this stage. So you say you've just been to America. What were you doing in America?
I went to the States to college. I went to a junior college on a scholarship deal, but I lasted one semester and came home. It really didn't suit me, and I got a bit homesick, missed my mum and dad, and I found it extremely boring, to be honest, to go from leaving school in the UK at 16 and playing golf every day and working at it to being back in school doing, you know, studying stuff that I wasn't really interested in at 18, 19. So I ended up coming home, and then I felt like I worked really hard from being sort of just turning 19 through to that St Andrews Links without having really a lot of success. So it was nice to finally get a win over the line.
Sure. St Andrews Links Trophy, not everyone will know what that tournament is, but in the amateur stakes, it's one of the biggies, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the biggest. It's one of the biggest. So if you look at the way that the amateur world rankings work, that's one of the highest points can be earned in the St Andrews Links. So you sort of have the US Amateur Championship, the British Amateur Championship, and then you drop down a level to sort of the Livham Trophy, the St Andrews Links Trophy, and then all the National Opens, and obviously the British Amateur and the US Amateur match play. So if you win something like the Livham Trophy or the St Andrews Links or the Irish Amateur Open, something like that, they're four-round stroke play. They're seen as proper tournaments to win. So that's one of the biggest ones that you can get on your CV.
And in the amateur circles at that time, would it be fair to say you weren't necessarily one of the names that would have been picked out as a potential winner?
I was nowhere near it. I was a complete underdog. Obviously, Tommy Fleetwood and Tom Lewis, Eddie Pepperell, people like that were your highest sort of ranked English players. And then people like Peter Uihlein was over from the States, and Brooks Koepka would have probably been around whether he played or not. Victor Dubuisson definitely played that week. And it's a really strong field, and there's a strong field every year at St Andrews. So out of the full field that was there, I was probably in the bottom sort of 20 or 30 to be expected to win it.
And I know there's going to be a theme, I think, that's going to develop in this interview, and it's going to refer to Links Golf. But here you are at the home of golf. I know the first couple of rounds were over the Jubilee Links, and then the last two rounds were at St Andrews. Did you feel, though, coming to that week, that even though your perception was as an underdog, did you feel that this was a kind of venue that would maybe suit you and where you really would have a chance?
No, I didn't put anything into the week. I was going to quit the week before. I finished bogey at the Scottish Amateur at Glasgow Gales. I didn't even change my golf shoes. I threw the clubs in the car and I drove home. That was me done. Got back to Southend and had no intention of playing in the St Andrews Links at all. And I got persuaded by my girlfriend at the time to go back up and play. And her point was, if you're going to leave it all at the home of golf. So I don't know how she ever persuaded me to play. I was done. So I drove back up the day before the tournament. I had never seen the other course. I walked the Jubilee course in the evening that I got there. I didn't hit a ball, didn't do any practice. I spent the back nine pretty much on the phone. I called my sister where I was down in the dumps. My eldest sister Anna is one of my best friends, and I didn't really take in anything of the back nine. I just sort of strolled around, and I got there on the day of the tournament. I didn't warm up. I didn't hit any putts. I don't even think I put my laces on my shoes. You know, I really didn't care. I remember I got the clubs from the car. I didn't tee it up on the first. I hit an iron. I hit a 3-iron. I got announced on the tee, and I just threw the ball on the floor. Just, you know, just get me out of here sort of thing. And I remember I just ripped it up the middle. And I just thought, well, you know, it's just standard. I always hit it good. You know, I've always been a ball striker off of that links turf. But, you know, it wasn't not to be arrogant, but I just thought, standard. You know, I've hit the fairway with a 3-iron. And I sort of hit a decent shot into the green to about 20, 25 feet. And I, again, didn't really think about it. You know, I didn't think, oh, it's a great shot. Or, you know, I'm playing great or anything like that. Just picked the bag up, got to the green. And I remember just hitting that putt. And when the putt got 3 foot from the hole, it just looked like one of those that couldn't miss. And something in my brain just said, well, it's not going to go in. I mean, when was the last time anything went right, sort of thing? And it went straight in the middle of the hole. And instantly, it was like someone just flipped the switch. As soon as that putt went in, my brain just said, you're going to win this. Like from the first hole of a 72-hole tournament, I went from not wanting to be there, the whole world's against me, nothing ever goes my way, to, hang on a minute, something just went right. And I've just flushed two shots within what felt like the next hour, felt like a minute. And I was sort of 4-under, top of the leaderboard, finished the day leading the tournament. And it never crossed my mind that I wouldn't win. I went from not wanting to play and never won a big amateur tournament to I'm going to win this. You know, this one's not going to get away from me. I've had enough. You know, it was like a caged animal. I'd been backed into a corner and this is my chance to get out. And that was it. I was coming out fighting. I was never going to give that away.
You obviously know how ridiculous in a way that sounds.
Yeah, it is. It's completely ridiculous. Yeah, it really. That's why it's my round. That's why it's the round that changed everything for me. I'd felt like I'd spent a long time. I obviously grew up in Southend. It can be a lovely place at times, but it can be quite a negative attitude around. It's, you know, there's towns and cities in England that are a bit sort of grey, aren't they, and rough around the edges. And that's, I think, Southend falls into that category. And it was very difficult to sort of grow up down Southend seafront, having these hopes and dreams of being this amazing pro golfer, and then kind of held back by watching people not sort of achieve their potential. So to come out and achieve something of that magnitude at the home of golf was, you know, it is a ridiculous story, and that's why it's my round. Obviously, I had the talent in there to do that, but that was the first time it ever came out.
So by the halfway stage, you mentioned you're going to the top of the leaderboard. You're sharing the lead with a Dane at the halfway stage and a guy from Trevose, Ben Westgate. Yeah. Third round, I think Stiggy Hodgson popped up in front. He was a very good amateur player. He shot around a 67 in the third round. So you're one behind going into this final round. But have you still got that feeling that you've had from holding that first putt?
It never crossed my mind. So when Ben was brilliant, I've never actually spoken to Ben about the St Andrews Links after playing. He was brilliant to play with because you played 36 holes on the final day. So we played round 3 in the morning and round 4 in the afternoon. And Ben was brilliant to play with. And I think Ben could see somehow, I think he could see how determined I was and how I was really looking after every shot. And he could obviously see my passion for it. I felt like I was completely my own world of focus, and he was really supportive. So when Stiggy had gone one in front, I never even noticed. I didn't know that until you've just said that. You know, it's like 8 years down the line. I didn't know that I'd been caught. I just thought, I'm playing the best golf here, so I'm going to win, you know. The only person that I ever looked at, it's a lovely story as well, was Tom Lewis, because I went down the ninth hole and Tom went up the tenth on the final round. And I had a quick look, and there was a leaderboard behind the ninth green, and it said Lewis, and then whatever score he was on, and then Southgate, and we were tied. Tom looked at me, and we were good friends from amateur golf, and I played with Tom quite a few times as an amateur, and he looked at me, and he nodded, just in an acknowledgement, as just like a hello sort of thing as he walked past. And I looked at him, and I just thought, not today. Like, you're not doing this to me today. I'm going to kill you. Like, it was kill. It was like, seeing his face and seeing his name at the top of the leaderboard was like red mist. Like, I mustn't, I've got to beat Tom Lewis. And Tom went par, par, double, par, double. And I went par, par, birdie, par, birdie. So all of a sudden we've gone from tied for the lead. The next time I see a leaderboard, I'm now like 4 in front, 5 in front. Tom had dropped down to third. Stiggy was second. And I was, you know, the leaderboard might as well just have big capital letters, you're going to win this. You know, as soon as I saw that, I thought, right, just look after what you're doing. And just keep, you know, sort of go through the motions, get this done, like get it over the line. So Tom was the only person I'd ever really sort of considered in the whole event. And I remember Tom, he obviously a gentleman he is and a good friend of mine, he came over at the back of the 18th and he really congratulated me. And I felt that was pretty special for me and Tom to do that, because Tom can be one of the most competitive golfers you'll ever meet. He's, you know, he's been compared to sort of Nick Faldo and people like that. Tom's a lovely guy, but when he's in his own zone when it comes to golf. I mean, there's not many people that want it more than Tom. He's pretty passionate about it. And what was lovely was the following year I turned pro and Tom went on to win the St Andrews Links. And I hadn't spoken to him for a while, obviously, where I was on the Challenge Tour. He was still playing amateur golf, so we hadn't really crossed paths. I called him and he didn't have my number saved in his phone. And he said, hello. I said, it feels good, that, doesn't it, Tom? And he said, who's that? I said, you can have one guess. And he said, it's got to be Southgate. That. I said, yeah. And we just had this long chat about what it felt like walking up the 18th and sort of knowing you were going to win. So it was lovely that, you know, to beat him the way I beat him and then him to get his name on the trophy right behind me the year after was pretty special.
So what did it feel like? You know, you're walking up that 18th, that famous 18th at St Andrews.
What was strange was that I was very calm. Obviously, you can't ask for an easier tee shot. The 18th at St Andrews is wide open. And what was the Open was at St Andrews in 2010. And they'd already built the grandstand on the left-hand side. So you can miss the fairway left. I mean, if you hit a real hard hook, you could hit it left and end up in, you know, out of bounds or in trouble. But the stand was there, so you couldn't hit it too far left. If I did it left, it was just going to hit the stand and stay in bounds. So I couldn't fail. I was aiming so far away from the road that I was never going to hit it out of bounds right, and out of bounds left didn't exist. So that was quite, I was kind of calm hitting that tee shot on 18. And then when I got down there, I was hiding under an umbrella. It was horrible. The weather was horrible. And the ball was actually on the path that goes across the 18th. So called a ref, and it's in play. It's still in play today. I think it was there before the golf course was there, so it's an integral part of the course. So I had a guy from Carnoustie, a family friend, came over to caddy for me, and he was all panicked. Yeah, just chip it off. And I said, that's all right, I've got it, like, chill out. And I walked up and there was a divot, and I worked out the yardage from this divot was 75 yards to the pin. And I had like a little knockdown shot that I played 75 yards, played it pretty good. So I said, like, let's not just chip it off, I'm going to aim for that divot. Like just get it near that divot and I'll have a good yardage. And chipped it off and it lipped out the divot. It was only sort of 20 yards, but I bundled it up 20 yards. I hit the crispest pitch I've ever hit and it just went to like 2 foot. And there were so many people around the back of the green, and some of my family had come up, my best friend Josh had come up, and they're all going wild around the green. I didn't even hear them. I just got back under the umbrella and in my own world. And as I marked the ball, I was really nervous, you know, really shaking, really nervous.
Even though you've got, I think, a five shot lead.
I've got a 5 shot lead.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I got over the putt, I looked at the hole and it looked like a pinprick. You know, you couldn't fit a ball in the hole. I was that nervous. I thought, I can't, I'm not going to hole this. And as soon as I looked at the hole and thought, it doesn't matter if I hole it or not. I can 5 putt and still, you know, 4 putt from here. I'm 2 foot from the hole. And as soon as I thought that, I thought, well, I can't fail. You know, I can't fail, it's brilliant. And so obviously, I just tapped it in the middle and it was quite funny because I hadn't really been getting on with my dad for whatever reason, and he was very upset I'd gone home from the Scottish Amateur the week before. And he turned up, he watched me play the last round, and it was pretty emotional, to be honest, that he was there and he didn't say a word to me. He stayed out of the way and he didn't get involved. And when I came up the 18th, there must have been 40, 50 people left of the green, loads of people behind the green, behind the fence. And then, I don't know how he got there, but my dad was on the right-hand fringe and the pin was cut on the right. So when I knocked in my putt, I never knew what I was going to do to celebrate. Never won a tournament before, a big tournament. I remember I just dropped the putter and went straight to dad. And we hadn't really spoken for a couple of weeks. And we just had this big emotional hug on the 18th at St Andrews. And it's one of the most amazing things to share with your dad, you know. And I think that's why it was so special to me. It's still special to me now, talking about it now. It gets me a bit jangly now talking about it. But it was an amazing feeling when that last putt went in.
Do you think your dad was upset with you at the time where you weren't talking, because here was this talent, which you obviously were, he was ready to throw it all away? And he'd obviously invested quite a lot of time and effort into helping you get to that point.
Yeah, we spent so much time when I was a kid talking about going to the States and having a scholarship, and that's what the best players did, you know.
And you quit that after a semester.
And I've quit, you know, and I was, it was very strange because, I mean, my mum, we get on great, you know, don't get me wrong, we're a really lovely family. But my mum was so disappointed that I came home, she could barely look at me, you know, and she didn't know what I was going to do. It was like everything that we planned, going to the States and coming back this great golfer, has now, you know, gone to pot, and what's going to happen next? So I was living with my dad, and he said that you can live here, but you need to get yourself a job. You know, we've put everything into your golf. If you don't want to play, then then you're gonna have to work. And we lived in a flat, but he'd had a loft conversion done. So he slept upstairs and I slept downstairs. So there was a period of time where I was waking up in the morning and I was coming to the golf club and practicing. You know, this could be 5:30, 6 in the morning. And that probably went on for a few weeks, 3-4 weeks. I was so determined to show my dad that I wanted to play and improve and that I didn't want to give up. It's just that I didn't want to be in the States. I was so unhappy away from my parents. I felt like I couldn't improve in the States because I had to be happy to play well, and that wasn't happening. So I remember coming down, I was down here, we got a short practice area on the 8th here at Thorpe, and I was hitting some pitches, and there was a rustle in the trees. That's a bit strange. I looked up, didn't think anything of it, carried on. Heard another rustle in the trees, so I've looked up, and my dad came out of the trees. And he said, he was angry, and he said, "What on earth are you doing?" Well, I said, "Well, I'm practicing." He said to me, "Practicing for what? You're not a golfer anymore." And I said, come on, Dad, I'm always going to be a golfer." He said, what are you practicing for?" He said, "I didn't think you wanted to play golf anymore." I said, "Dad, I never said I didn't want to play. I just didn't want to be in the States. I just wanted to be here. I wanted to be here and do it my way. I think the States has opened my eyes to how hard I've got to work and how it's not just going to come easy. But I feel like I can do the work here and do it a lot happier being at home." So he gave me a big cuddle. He saw the divots that were there, and it was quite obvious that they were my divots. You know, there's patches and patches and patches where I've been working on different distance control stuff. And that was it. We went home and we had a bit of a chat. And a few days later, he gave me his credit card and said, "I don't want you to worry about the golf. I haven't really got the money, but you're my best friend. And I know you'll never go overboard with spending the money on your golf. You know, whatever you need, I just want you to know that I support you, and I, you know, this is something you're good at, so let's, you know, continue to try and get better at it." So obviously the outcome of all that was pretty nice at that time.
I mean, that's an extreme low to
an
ultimate high for you, as you mentioned, the round. Is that something that you do often, or was that a one-off?
No, it's a bit of a one-off, to be honest, that one. I mean, I've had a few ups and downs in my career, and I think that's the same with any sportsman, really. I don't think a consistent career really exists, does it, in golf, especially in golf. I mean, it's such a tough game that things go right and wrong. And I think maybe I had a serious lack of experience playing tournament golf courses when I stepped up a level to that sort of international amateur stuff. I think it was... I didn't have the experience to get a win over the line. I had the ability to do it. I had more than enough ability to do it, but it just wasn't happening. So when I won at St Andrews, I didn't play golf that I'd never played before. I flushed the ball for years. I was a ball striker when I was 14, 15 years old. I hit the ball great. So it was just putting it all together for 4 days on a proper golf course under that sort of tournament pressure and the big names in the game at that time, obviously the amateur game around you. So St Andrews wasn't the... I wasn't overperforming. It was just the first time it had happened on that sort of level.
So did that make you realise that you could then cut it as a professional golfer? Because you did turn pro not that long after.
Yeah, the biggest thing for me about that was that it put my mind at rest. I didn't have to worry about anyone else anymore. I used to turn up to things like the Brabazon Trophy and I'd see Tommy Fleetwood and all of a sudden I'm second. And then I'd see Tom Lewis and I was third. And then Eddie would walk around the corner and I was fourth. And come the first round, I'm now teeing off the first thing, and I've actually got to play pretty good to finish top 10 here, top 15. Whereas when I played well at St Andrews, all of a sudden it was, when Matt Southgate plays well, Matt Southgate wins tournaments. So let's just focus on being Matt Southgate for the day. And that's obviously a lot easier to control than worrying about what everybody else was doing.
And you played Challenge Tour fairly early on, first year 2011. You had a fairly quick runners-up finish in Scotland. So you had a decent start, but I think it's fair to say you got to the European Tour. It was a bit of a struggle to start with.
Yeah, it was a struggle, yeah. It was, and I think exactly what I just said about judging other people. I think when I first came on tour, 2011, I didn't know anyone. You know, players that were really, really good players, even like my manager, Sam Little, you know, I'd never met Sam, never seen him hit a golf ball before, but the guy could play. And all of a sudden, I've gone from being one of the best amateurs in the world and turning up and going, "Who's Sam Little? And he's just beat me by 6. You know, I don't even know who he is." And then the next day you play with someone like a Gary Houston, you go, well, you know, with no offence to Gary, he's a great guy, but you sort of think, oh, he's got to be sort of at the end of his career, not that great. He shoots 65, and you think, how did he do that? You know, I've just played well and shot level par, and the guy's just shot 7 under, and he doesn't, He hasn't got the same swing and he doesn't look like he's got the same ability as me. But I think when I first came on the tour, I didn't care about anybody else. Whereas the second and third year on tour, I knew everybody else and I was friends with them. And I had almost too much respect, I think, for a lot of players. And I think that's what prevented me really from winning on the Challenge Tour. And again, I'd go to tour school every year and get that done. As soon as it was sort of nitty-gritty golf, I was good at it. So I always sort of stayed afloat and kept the card through that.
2012-13, and I know in 2013 you played about 20 events. You didn't really come that close to keeping your card. Did those doubts, you know, you talked about the Scottish amateur throwing the clubs in the boot and thinking that's that. Did the doubts creep in again there?
I just don't think I knew what I was doing, really. I was very inexperienced. I didn't have a clue how to schedule. I was getting a lot of phone calls on a Tuesday to go and play in tournaments. You know, I'd be ready to go to play in a Challenge Tour and then I'd end up pulling out and going to play on the main tour. And then everything was last minute, no practice round, you know, scrabbling about for a caddy. The amount of like caddies I had just for 1 week, can you just do the week? And because obviously the Challenge Tour, you're pulling your own trolley and the main tour, you've got to take a caddy. So it's a lot of last minute things. And I think 2012 and 13, I kind of got stuck between two tours. I didn't have great playing rights on the main tour to be playing every week or any of the big tournaments. And then I'd obviously played pretty good on the Challenge Tour in 2011. And it wasn't boredom, but I felt like I wanted to push to play on the main tour, even though I probably would have been better off staying put on the Challenge and doing my apprenticeship, as it were.
2014, the end of 2015, some seismic moments, I think it's fair to say, happened in your personal life. First of all, with your niece and then with yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that period like for you? I mean, was golf secondary? I mean, we'll get into the details of it if that's okay with you, but where did golf come at the end of 2014 and the first half of 2015 after the things you went through?
It's all a bit of a blur, really. It's difficult to... I'm so determined as a golfer. Golf was never out of my mind, never. I mean, no chance of that. As selfish as it sounds, I'm very good at switching off the things that I can't control. I love my niece to bits, but I can't control anything with her getting better or getting worse or potentially passing away. You know, I distanced myself from that situation knowing that I had no control over it.
She had leukemia and obviously you were very heavily involved.
Heavily involved in trying to, yes, you see, that's how I react. That's how winners react, I think. You don't sit around feeling sorry about something you can't do anything about it. Can I go and earn a load of money for the charity and raise a bit of awareness and get behind it? Yeah, I can. So let's get up and organise a charity golf day. Let's get some awareness out there. Let's get a bit of love spreading around the town and get something behind her, because that's what I can do as an uncle. I can't go and sit in Great Ormond Street and make the kid better. The doctors and nurses are doing that. Stay out of the way, let them do their job. Let's all get together as a family and try. That's how my brother, I'm a doer. You know, I'm a fixer. I want to do it, fix it, you know. So that's how I was getting on with that. And I was obviously still working hard at my golf. I was playing great. I think 2015 was about the best golf I've played up till obviously coming through on the main tour. But that start of my career, that was as good as it had gotten.
And in July, you could go to Germany and, you, as you say, you're playing well, fifth there.
Yeah, I played brilliant. And that was the first time I remember putting the scorecard in Germany and thinking that was the first time I'd ever had a good result and it felt easy. Everything else had always felt tough. When I finished runner-up at the Scottish Hydro in 2011, it felt hard work. You know, I held a really good putt of the last to come second. And I remember feeling very drained. I got in the car to come home from Scotland after that event. Two of my friends had driven up, so I was supposed to fly home, but I ended up driving home with them. And I remember sitting in the car and feeling physically exhausted. It had drained me getting that result and finishing runner-up to Edouard Dubois, who played great, and I played great, but it was a strain, whereas Germany was easy. I mean, I just floated around 4 days as if I was just playing social golf, and a lot of the stuff that I had, 2014 was a bit of a dead year for me, so I didn't play much tournament golf, and it gave me a lot of time to put some energy and focus into the weaknesses in my game. Top of the list, obviously, being putting, and I felt like my putting that week in Germany was easy. I didn't worry about it, so it was a really lovely feeling to get on the flight home from Germany and think, oh, I'm slowly getting there now. You know, I get it. I've just finished top 10, and I felt like I just flicked it around 4 days, the same as playing with your mates, rather than under sort of tournament pressure.
But something must have felt wrong, because you had some test results, so you must have... Did you go seeking something? Did you feel something wasn't right?
No, so I went to with my story, I went out on a Friday night on a bit of a party night with some friends, and then Saturday I'm obviously a massive Chelsea fan, and I was getting picked up to go to Stamford Bridge on the Saturday morning, and I woke up, I was so hungover, I got in the shower and I showered with my eyes shut, and I felt that I had a problem with the left testicle, and it didn't feel right at all, and I'm not really one that would run to the GP, but I thought I've definitely got to go, so I went to the football, and you know, I wasn't in too much pain or anything like that. And then went to the doctors on the Monday. He reassured me, gave me some tablets, and said, you know, you've got a cyst on the left testicle. The tablets will knock it out. You're fine to go to Germany and play. Don't worry about it. But we will send you for a scan. So I went for a scan on the Monday afternoon. Boarded the flight on the Tuesday. Played great. Came home. When I got home, I got a phone call on the Monday morning to say to get into the doctors. The tablets have been working, which was lovely, really. I was playing in Germany thinking, oh, this is great, the cyst going down, everything's great. Pulled into the doctors on the Monday. The left testicle was absolutely fine, but they'd found a tumour in the right one, which was obviously another one of my extreme cases of luck, or, you know, it's a freak thing. Gone to the doctors complaining about the left testicle, there's no problem with it, and they find a tumour in the right one. It's amazing. So at that stage, I didn't have a lot of starts and stuff, so the top 10 in Germany had got me into, I think it was Slovakia, was the following week, and obviously couldn't play and got taken straight into hospital to have the testicle removed, and then it was all a bit up in the air, so there was a few sleepless nights there where I sort of think, am I dying here, or you know what, I don't know what's going to happen next. I didn't really know what the outcome was going to be, and that was all a bit of a worry. And then obviously the week of my operation was the week of the Open, so 2014, I played my first major at Hoylake. I played dreadful, but I played. I got a player's badge. And then the following year, obviously, I'm stuffed up on the sofa, and I didn't miss a shot because I couldn't walk. So,
and ironically, given where the round was, it was at St Andrews.
It was at St Andrews, yeah. Yeah, it was strange. Obviously, sat there. I watched every shot of it, of that. And
did you ever contemplate during this period that, I mean, obviously, life is of most importance, and cancer obviously can be life-threatening, but did you think ever that your career might be over as well?
The only time I thought my career could be over, I went to my surgeon, who he's a great guy. He was a real sort of top specialist. I was lucky to get him. He was really good. He had a great sense of humour. He made everything as easy as it could have possibly been. And I remember walking in to see him in his office, and I had the schedule in my hand, and he said, he was a big black guy. He said, you're crazy. I said, well, why? This is my career. Like, when, you know, I want to get back playing again. I said, what can I play? He said, you're mad. I said, look, this is really important to me. Can you just go through the schedule and let me know what you think might happen? And he went down the list and he said, no, no chance, no chance, no chance, week to week, going down the list. And then he stopped at tour school, first stage of tour school, and he looked at me, and I'll never forget it, he looked at me, perfect eye contact, and he said, and he pointed and he said, you might be able to play this. And he had no idea what it was. He had no idea of the outcome it would have on me to play or not play that the tour school. Missing tour events was hard, but to miss the first stage of tour school after 2014, not having a card, 2015, you're scrapping for invites and stuff, not playing tour school at the end of 2015 is game over. I can't not make a living. I've got to have some form of income, and I'm not making any money out of the game of golf. It would have sent me into something else. So as soon as he stopped at that event, that was good enough for me. And my brain just went into, I've got to get ready for tour school mode. I was, you know, chipping and putting and doing as much as I possibly could. I was in absolute agony. I mean, I don't know how I ever done that. How I ever got through 2015 tour school is beyond me. I've never achieved anything that's that hard. It was grueling. You know, I was absolutely knackered to get through that 14 round process going all the way from first stage.
Because we're talking July to having the operation, to first stage being what, September?
Yeah, I imagine, last week of September, maybe first week of October, somewhere there. And
so, I mean, people telling you you're crazy.
I couldn't walk. I couldn't walk for a couple of weeks. And
you're trying to hit golf balls.
I'm hitting golf balls. I was putting on, I was down at my club putting, and I'd knock in 3-4 footers, and then I'd stand on a wedge, the head of the wedge, to get the grip up, and then flick the balls out with the wedge, and then drop the wedge, flick the putter up with my foot, and keep putting. And people come over and said, like, what are you doing? Why are you here? And my brain and my answer to them was, look, if I hurt myself doing this, I'm going to have I'm going to get rushed into hospital and they're going to sew me back up and it's going to hurt for a couple of days. If I don't do this, I can't get through tour school. And that's going to be agony for the rest of my life, knowing that I didn't do that. So it was a very polite way of sort of saying, look, shut up, leave me alone. This is what I'm doing. Whether you like it or not, I've got to be out. I'm not going to get through tour school unless my short game is as sharp as it can be. This isn't hurting too much. I can do this. And it was, you know, I had a good couple of weeks where it was just chipping and putting and chipping and putting, chip, like non-stop. I was like man possessed because I knew I wasn't going to have the power to play the long iron shots. I wasn't going to have the power to hit long drives. It was going to be a lot of sort of knock it out the fairway, knock it near the green, get it down in two. I knew that that was going to be the case. And yeah, I don't really know how I did that.
So it was first stage of qualifying school. Did you actually get to tee it up in anything to kind of give yourself a test run before?
I played Russia. I went out to Russia, got a phone call, and I thought...
Which is a European tour event.
European tour event, which was a couple of weeks before first round of first stage of tour school. And I said to my dad, I'm going to go to Russia. And he said, you're going to do what? I said, I'm going to go and play. And he was like, Matt, you can't, how can you get round 72 holes of golf? You can't go and play. I said, but, you know, if I don't go and play, I might never play on tour again. This could be it. This could be the last. Oh, I don't care if I miss the cut and shoot 90-90. I'd got to go and play because I owe that to myself. I think I can do it. And he just said, just go. Like, I'm not even going to comment, so I was fine. So I called up one of their caddies. He's a good friend of mine, Barry Love. I don't actually know. His second name's Cornwall, I think. Barry, is it Barry Cornwall?
Well, you call him Love, do you?
Barry Love. He calls everyone Love. Morning, Love. How are you doing, Love? He's great. And he caddied for me. I phoned him up and said, Baz, like, I need a favour. Can you caddy for me in Russia? He was like, I thought you weren't well. And I said, well, yeah, I'm all right. We'll get it round. But I'm probably going to miss the cut, you know, just to give you a bit of a heads up. I'll pay you the week's wages, but don't get your heart set on any commission because I'm just sort of going to go through the motions and see what we can do. I said, I have been practising, but we'll see how we do. And we ended up playing great. I finished 22nd, and I don't know how I did that. I don't know how I done it. There are photos of me playing that tournament, and I'm so overweight, and I just look knackered. And I don't know how I got done 72 holes, and then I made first stage look so easy, and I was so calm. And I knew I've always had such a fiery little temper on a golf course, and I knew I didn't have the energy to be like that. And I calmed myself down and just thought, look, this is. Now, this is something you've got to get done, and having a head off is not going to help that. So I played at about 75-80% power, and I just done what I could do and sort of cruised through. And in the back of my mind, all I thought was the further we go in this, the better I'm going to get. I'm going to get stronger. This is going to get better and easier.
And did it?
It did. Yeah, it really did. The further I went, the more confident I got. And when I got through to final stage, it was almost like I've come this far. I'm not going home without a card. You know, and I felt like I got a card that week because no one on the planet wanted a card more than I did. And I didn't care how I played. I didn't care whether the ball had a fade or a draw or if I duffed a chip. I didn't care. It was sheer determination of walking to the first tee, putting the ball on the tee and saying, this thing's going around this golf course in par or better. And I'd done that for 6 days. Like
98 holes. So when you finish that 98th hole...
They had to carry me up the hill at Catalunya. I couldn't get up that hill at the end. I was absolutely so. I just had nothing left in the tank. I was an emotional wreck. Because I'd been there before, I knew what that felt like to walk off that green with a card. And I knew what that meant. I knew what that entailed. And I knew how hard that was to do it. And to do it under those circumstances was just. I mean, it was beyond belief that I thought, wow, I've done it. You know, and I felt like I'd had to fight so hard from that Monday, getting told I couldn't go to Slovakia, through to that hole and getting it done, that it was all done. It was all finished. You know, I could just, I'm like getting emotional about it now. Like it was that sense of relaxation of it's done. You know, I'm finished. And the boys got me up. I don't know how they got me up that hill. And I'd done my scorecard. I checked the scorecard about 50 times. You know, I just kept going through the scorecard, 4-4-3, 4-3-5-4. You know, yeah, that's 34, yeah, 4-4-4. You know, going through the card and then back to the start. Make sure, you know, thinking, whatever you do, don't sign for it. You know, my life's so upside down and backwards and ridiculous at the minute. There's a chance I'll probably sign it wrong. And And then I walked out, and everybody wanted to obviously talk to me because it was amazing. And I couldn't speak. I couldn't get a word out without. I just kept crying. And the European Tour productions guys, they've been brilliant. They followed me for the week, and obviously it was quite a big story. And I'd had my card before, so people wanted to know what was going on. And I remember they had to interview me because I had to close out this big piece that they'd done. You know, they'd done, you know, practice rounds, they'd done evening, they came out with me for dinner just to talk to me about how I felt and stuff. It's quite good, really. They were good to have around. And I just said, look, if you're going to interview me to close this out, you can't really mention anything to do with my niece, or, you know, I'm just going to fall apart. So we tried and I failed. I couldn't do it. Tried again, couldn't do it. I ended up going up to the clubhouse and having 3 pints of lager, just about to do the interview to finish this thing. I'm on the balcony at Catalunya, and they asked me 2 questions. I managed to get answers out before just completely falling apart. So when you watch the interview back, it's actually quite cool because you look and think, oh, he's done quite well there. He's a bit emotional, but he's done well. Really, I was half cut, and it had taken me about 6 goes just to get 2 questions answered. So it was a real tough one. And I've got some beautiful photos of my family and friends. And that week, Richie McAvoy got his card. Obviously being a member at the same golf club as me, and we could fly from Barcelona to Southend. It was when EasyJet had just started flying out of Southend, and we landed and we were both a bit shattered, and we got our clubs, came through, and when we opened the automatic doors opened at arrivals, the arrivals hall was packed. You know, there was people there with champagne, all my family there, they'd all done big banners, and my cousin from the States was over, so he was there, and loads of people from the golf club were there, and it was a real like hero's welcome, and it was lovely to do that with Richie as well. It was an amazing time to do that, and I think having that determination and getting that done is why I played so much better in 2016 and 17 and stuff. I think that was the last, putting that all to bed and seeing that actually the hardest thing that could come my way was getting told I had cancer, and actually I can bury that and still play good golf is made me 6 inches taller as a person. You know, I turn up and I don't really care people fussing about the golf course or moaning about bits and pieces. It's a game that we all love playing, and it's in perspective for me. Is it annoying? Yeah, of course it is. Do I still bang clubs and swear? Yeah, of course I do. But underneath it all, I'm not upset with the game anymore. I don't want to give up like I did when I came home from the Scottish Amateur Open. And
so was that final round, was that so much harder than playing a final round in the Irish Open a few months later with Rory McIlroy and having a, you know, at the time your best ever finish on the European Tour when you finished fourth at that Irish Open?
When you play a tournament and there's prize money and ranking points and stuff, it's a game of chess. You have to decide when to go and when to sit. You know, you have to think, well, I'm going to go for that flag because I've got that shot, and you play it. And then other times you hit an iron off a tee because you need to hit the fairway or whatever. It's like a little game of chess. Whereas tour school, where there's, you don't need to win, you just need to be in the top 25, I think it was at that time. And it was a case of walking to the first tee in the top 5 of the tournament and thinking, don't do anything wrong. There was never anything to go for. You don't go for anything. You just, anything that can go wrong, you play away from. If you've got a perfect wedge number, but it could spin off the green, you knock it down and you get the spin off of it. And you make sure that that's what you do. If you're on a tee, par 5, and you're deciding that you've got to hit the fairway because you're playing it as a 3-shot hole, you hit the fairway. You don't stand there and hit it hard. You get it done. Whereas the Irish Open, you sort of think, I'll have a little roll of the dice here. You know, you think, I can go for this par 5 in 2. Let's give it a whack. And you know, if it goes wrong, you suffer the consequences. Whereas tour school, you can't afford to suffer the consequences because the consequence is having a card or not having a card, and that's too important. So they're two sort of different things, really. Tour school's its own little beast. It's a completely unique tournament.
But that Irish Open kind of was your arrival on the European Tour, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, to have that finish in that company at a tournament as prestigious as that.
Yeah, it's a weird one. Again, it was a last minute call up on a Tuesday, I think. I got the phone call Tuesday morning, sales first reserve. I booked the flight to go Wednesday morning, I think. I travelled out to the Irish Open. And when I landed, I had a text message on the phone saying I was in the tournament. So I called Dave Rankin, who was actually a local caddy at the K Club, and he was a European Tour caddy, but that was his home. And he said he worked for me for the week. So we went and had a quick stroll around on a Wednesday, and the pro-am was on, just looked at a few holes and then just played great. You know, the course suited me, the conditions suited me. I love the speed of the greens, and I just hit really good shots at the right time, and the crowd are amazing, you know. And I don't think I could have done it without the crowd. I remember being, I led the Scottish Open the year that Phil Mickelson won that, the one in a playoff, and I didn't sleep at that Scottish Open. I was so excited about playing. I wasn't nervous, I was excited, you know, and I was off teeing off late on the Saturday and playing with Ross Fisher. And I remember I woke up that morning and thought, on the Saturday morning of that Scottish Open, I thought, I'll go for a little walk along the beach. And I went out to the hotel and I was smoking at the time, lit a cigarette, coffee, walking along the beach. And after about 10 seconds, I realised I wasn't walking along the beach. I was like marching up and down. I was like parading up and down this beach. Any other people staying in a hotel that looked outside and thought, God, this is a madman. Who's he? Like, you know, I'm walking up and down in my pyjama bottoms and a T-shirt, coffee and a cigarette on the go. And I couldn't wait to play, and it ruined me. I played terrible that Saturday. So they say you learn from your mistakes. So I sort of tried to learn from that. And I thought, if I'm ever in that position again on that Friday night going into a big weekend on the Saturday, I'm going to have a few beers. I'm just going to be myself and act like nothing's happened. Just try and make sure I get a good night's sleep, and then we'll try that. You know, trial and error sort of thing.
Sure.
So there we are that Friday, and the draw comes out. I'm playing with Rory McIlroy at the Irish Open. I've got the King of Ireland. I've got the best player in the world at the time. I'm playing with world number one. He's Irish at the Irish Open. So I executed the game plan of going to the Players' Miss Cup party, having a few beers and just being me. And I remember that night, I had a few beers, I had a big plate of food, and Paul McGinley was sat in the corner, and I'd never really spoken to Paul. I knew he was, obviously, but I went over to Paul and I said, you got any advice for me? He said, what do you mean? I said, I've never done this before. You know, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I'm playing with Rory tomorrow, and this is the biggest tournament I've ever, you know, found my name in the top of the sort of leaderboard. And he said, I'll give you one bit of advice and it'll definitely work. He said, walk to the first tee tomorrow and get the crowd on your side as quick as you can. He said, by the third or fourth, they'll like you. And as soon as they like you, they'll start pulling for you and you'll feel it. I didn't really know what he meant. So I thought, okay, I'll take that on board. So I knew where Rory was. And I thought, I've got to get to the first tee first, because he's obviously going to cause such a scene when he gets there. I need to go and get my own little applause onto the tee and you know, acknowledge the crowd or whatever. So I did. I done exactly what Paul McGinley had said. I walked up to the first tee. I took my hat off. I waved to everybody, smiled at everybody. And you know, when they announced me on the tee, I was, you know, obviously very much focused, but I was very wary to make sure that I waved to the crowd and make sure I did the right thing. And you know, almost like an entertainer, make sure you entertain the crowd. And I hit a great shot into the first, and my putt got halfway to the hole. And the crowd, that noise, the crowd like swelled, go on, go on, go on. And I could feel it, like on the first green, Paul had said three or four holes. And the thing went in, and it was like the crowd had dragged the ball in the hole. Yeah, the cheer went up. And I thought, wow, like this is what it's all about. I'm, you know, Rory's made par, I've made birdie, here we go, we're off. You know, and that was, you can't, how can you settle into a round with the best player in the world better than ripping a 3-wood down a tight hole and getting it up and down with an 8-iron, you know. And it was the whole way around. They people patting on me, leaning over the ropes, patting me on the back. And I think playing in that environment was it was an amazing experience, but it was relaxing. And I was like, what the people wanted me to do well, and I wanted to do well for them. And it was like that the whole tournament, the whole weekend, that whole Saturday, Sunday was, I wasn't knocking in putts for me. I was knocking in putts because I was like doing it for the people, do it for the crowd. Like they all wanted me to do well. So I wanted to give them something to cheer about. And that was really special, and you could see that when I got going emotional again. When I finished the last at the K Club, my dad was there, and they had a big walkway back to the clubhouse, and it was railinged off both sides, but 2 yards wide, and you walk through these railings. The amount of people that were hanging over the railings and like hugging me and banging me on the back, and my dad was at the end of it just to obviously just say well done and gave me a big cuddle and get the party started, as it were. But those fans were, I'm not Irish, but it was like they took me on as like one of their own, and it was great fun. And obviously when I went back last year, they were all there again. You know, it was that first tee at Paul Stewart. It was like, wow, you're all back. Here's all the people that want me to do well. And I don't think it's surprising at all. It's not, when people say to me about the Irish Open, Corey, you've done well at the Irish Open a couple of times, and you go, yeah, but they weren't the same golf course. I played one at the K Club, which is like a great big parkland course, and one at Port Stewart, which is a tight fiddly links course. It's got nothing to do with where we were playing. I think it's got more to do with why I wanted to do well. Why do I want to do well? And it's like, I love the game of golf, and I know 1,000 people that love the game of golf, but that Irish crowd, all of them love it the same way as I do. They're so knowledgeable. and they get behind me like I'm Irish. It's amazing. So it's a lovely feeling.
Yeah, which kind of should move me to the Open, because there's I think a similar feel for you when you played the Open Championship. But I'd like to finish on a positive note, but there's one other thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is a little bit more negative, which was your experience at the Web.com Tour Finals with that bizarre incident. So it's a four, if people don't know, it's a four tournament thing, really, the finals. Top 25 get their card. You were very well placed after two events, and you're playing the third event, and it's pretty close to the finish, and you're on the 15th hole. Was it a par five?
Yeah, par four, short par, short par four. I had a good tee shot, and then I was on a great number with my wedge shot into the green, and it went, I don't know how, but it went over the back of the green. I didn't hit a great chip shot. And then obviously I hit the putt, and millions of people have seen what happened to the putt with the leaf hitting the ball, and the rest is history, really.
You say everyone's seen it, but for those.
A lot of people, yeah, well, obviously I hit the putt, the ball got halfway to the hole, and it wasn't even a windy day. This little leaf managed to get enough speed to blow across the line. It smacked the edge of the ball. The ball sort of deviated maybe 4 or 5 inches, missed the hole. I was playing with Ben Crane, and we both just looked at each other, wow. And he, I haven't got a great American accent, but he, whoa, never seen anything that unlucky, man. I was like, that's amazing. You know, there's me, like, London accent. Wow, that was amazing, with a F in the middle of it. And he shrugged his shoulders, and I just went and tapped it in. You know, I just sort of tapped the ball in, no problem, off we go. It rattled me a bit, but I think I parred the next, and 17 was a really difficult par three. I made bogey there, everybody made bogey there. It was like a borderline of par four. And then I just switched off. I had a dreadful tee shot of 18, ended up making 7, which obviously didn't help the cause. And when I got in, I thought, it's not the end of the world. I've got my card up, that's okay, you know. I'm going to finish wherever I was for the tournament, 30th or something, 34th or something. And then I had my lunch, I was going to put the clubs in the car, and a referee came over and he said, have you seen this footage? And I said, no, but I know what it's going to be. You know, I know it has to be that leaf. So he played the video to me and he said, did you see the leaf hit the ball? I said, yeah, of course I saw the leaf hit the ball. It's my ball. Like, I've hit an 8-foot putt. Yeah, of course I saw the leaf hit the ball. He said, well, you've actually broken the rules. You had to replay the putt. I said, well, I tapped it in and made a 5. If I'd have replayed it, more chance of me making 4. Surely that can't be right. He said, no, we've sent the video to a couple of other referees and they've said the same, rule 19B, whatever it is. And they were right. And obviously the ruling was wrong. And then it hit me. Then I thought, well, if I've got the ruling wrong, then I've got the scorecard wrong as well, because I've just signed the scorecard half an hour ago. So then there was a big back and forwards thing. They called John Paramore to... which is a bit offensive, really. I think they called John Paramore to make sure I wasn't, you know, didn't have any previous, as if I was trying to pull a fast one or something, which obviously John laughed at him and said, no, he's you know, straight as a die. And so we sat down and it went, they thought it was a 2-shot penalty, then they thought it was a 4-shot penalty, then it was talks of me being disqualified. I was very calm about it. I was sort of almost laughing about it. You know, I didn't really think about the consequence of what that was going to, you know, that leaf has ended up costing me a PGA Tour card, but I still had an event left, so I kind of, and I hadn't played great, and I had made 7 up the last, and I was already disappointed, and it was almost like that sort of dry British sense of humour. It was almost like a Basil Fawlty moment. Like, what more can go wrong? You've got to laugh at it, rather. It's not a disaster. This is a joke. You know, someone's got to be playing a game, and someone's going to jump out of a bush and say, like, you've been framed or something.
Because the bizarre thing is, I mean, you'd think a leaf hitting a golf ball would have a minor.
It had a big effect, and you could hear it.
It's like a rock hit it.
Yeah, but it really did hit the ball. I mean, you could hear the noise. I can still, when I get in bed sometimes, I can still hear the noise of that leaf hitting the ball. What's amazing for me is, like, look at that, and there's another like 5 or 6 leaves exactly the same place. If you watch the video, it's on YouTube and stuff. There's a little group of leaves, and that's the only one that moves. And I've always thought, how did that one leaf get enough power to hit the ball and move it when the other 5 leaves don't even move? So it wasn't like it was windy. It wasn't windy, you know. It was a really lovely summer's day. It wasn't windy at all. So,
but it's a stupid rule, isn't it?
Well, it's a rule. Rules are rules, you know.
But it's still a stupid one.
It's a strange rule. I don't know whether it's a stupid rule. I think the rules of golf are there for everybody to follow. And if everybody follows the rules, then it should be the fairest game in the world. And when you look at other sports, I find football outrageous. I love football, but the diving and the cheating is just pathetic, you know. And I take great pride in being a golfer and playing by the rules and knowing that we could all go and play golf this afternoon in a one ball, and if you're open and honest and you play by the rules, then whatever score you shot, you shot. You don't really need, I know that I can trust myself. I could go and play a four-round golf tournament in a one ball, and whatever I shoot, that's what I shot. You know, I'm never going to lay in bed with a guilty conscience thinking, oh, well, I didn't take that drop, and I shouldn't have done that, you know. I didn't actually hold that putt, but I wrote down a four, which is effectively what they do in football. The ball goes out for a throw-in, and every player on the pitch claims that it's their throw-in. You know, that's whereas in golf, we all play by the rules. So is it a silly rule? Yeah, it's harsh, but it is there in black and white, and it is the same for all of us. And the fact that it happened to me is a bit unlucky, obviously, because it could have happened to anyone else. But, I mean, you can't blame the rule book. If I'd have known the rule book inside out, I'd have replayed the shot, I'd have probably knocked it in, and I'd probably have a PGA Tour card. But that doesn't mean to say that I'd be a better golfer. It doesn't mean to say I'd be higher up the world rankings or anything. So maybe I'm not a believer in things happen for a reason, but maybe that one was a reason to keep me on the European Tour, because there's maybe bigger success waiting here than there is over there. So I'd have never gone to the web.com finals if I didn't have such an amazing position in Europe with the Rolex series, and benefiting from the stuff that Keith Pelly's managed to sort out. And I'd have never have gone if I was only just coming off the Challenge Tour or something. I wouldn't have gone out there. So I always had Europe to fall back on, and Europe's my home. So it's disappointing, but it's not not the end of the world.
And I said I wanted to end on a more positive note with the Open. And we've mentioned already that you played 2014, that you were in hospital watching 2015. But your love affair with that championship goes back a lot further, doesn't it?
Yeah, I got taken to the Open when I was a kid, and that was like my summer holiday. I was never at school for the last like week of the school holidays, but without putting him in trouble, the headmaster at my school sat down with my parents and said, look, he's going to learn a lot more at the Open than he is sitting in the classroom here. You know, he's quite obvious that he's passionate about this, and I'm behind him. You know, he sort of said, you know, off the record, the school's not behind him taking time out of school, but I'm behind him because I think he's got something special. And the whole way through my, you know, being at school that period, my dad would take me out, and we went to the Open. That's what we did, and we used to camp out. I went to every Open between 1999 and playing my first one in 2014. And my dad had missed qualifying for the Open a couple of times, very narrowly missed one year by, I think he missed by a shot once, and it was heartbreaking for him, and I could see how much the Open meant to him as a kid, and it rubbed off on me. And I just remember sitting, that was sitting on that little bridge, my legs dangling over the water at the 18th at Carnoustie when Van der Velde was in the water, and that was right in front of me. And I just remember not really knowing what was going on, you know, because I was only 10 years old, so I didn't really know what was happening. And then I remember Paul Laurie crossed the bridge right in front of me. There were two bridges, like one members' bridge and one players' bridge, and I was sat on like the members' bridge that was roped off, and one of the chief marshal got me on this bridge. So I had a perfect view of the whole green and everything. And I just remember when Paul Laurie walked over that bridge, he got a standing ovation from the crowd that I'd never seen that before. I'd been to Chelsea games. My dad was a big Chelsea fan. I'm a big Chelsea fan. I've been to Chelsea for 5 years, you know, since I was 5 years old. So I'd seen crowds going wild, and I'd seen the love of other, you know, sportsmen and stuff. Watching Paul Laurie cross that bridge and hearing that cheer, that was me sitting there and thinking, that's what I'm going to do. That's what I want to do. That's what I think I can do. That's what I'd like to do. My brain as a 10-year-old said, I'm going to do that. That's where I'm going to go. That's what, I've never seen anything like that. So to end up playing in the Open and then obviously doing well at the Open is a lovely story, and it is the best. It's the best tournament by miles, I think. Obviously I've never played the Masters or anything, but it can't beat the Open.
Because you finished 12th in 2016, you had an incredible weekend in 2017, which means you're definitely playing at Carnoustie.
Yeah.
In 2018. Did you, because your dad's a member at Carnoustie.
Yeah, I'm a member as well, yeah, but it was my 16th birthday present was membership at Carnoustie, and a bit of a reward for getting cut to scratch. My dad said, if you're going to be a member at Carnoustie, you've got to be a proper player, so you're not joining until you're off scratch. And I got down to scratch when I was 16, so that was like 16th birthday present, and I've kept it going, and I've got some lovely friends up there, and obviously lovely to be going there for the Open this year.
And I read somewhere that you actually played the day after on that 18th at Carnoustie in 1999. You were caddying for
yeah,
your dad?
Yeah, we went out on, they'd done a ballot, they'd done a members ballot, so all the members put their name in a hat, and the ones that came out were lucky enough to play the championship course on the Monday after the Open when Paul Laurie won. And they, obviously Van der Velde had made his famous seven down the last, so there I was at 10 years old saying to my dad, like, let me play the hole. He said, well, you haven't got any clubs. I was just caddying for my dad. That's all right, I'll do it with yours, do it with the big clubs. I knocked it up short of the burn off the tee. I just laid it up because I couldn't carry the burn at 10 years old. It was only 100 yards or so. I couldn't do it. I laid it up down the fairway. I knocked it up to the burn just short of the green. I chipped on the putt. So I made a five, and I remember then the stands were all up, and I remember that putt going in it and thinking, I can do it, you know, I can do it, this is brilliant. It was all like a big role play thing as a 10-year-old, and all the adults patted me on the back and that. I felt like a hero, and I was like, obviously, you're only a little kid, you're 10 years old, but it was amazing, yeah, to still have that.
Because a five would have won.
Well, I think a six would have won as well, yeah, the seven got him in a playoff, and yeah, obviously Paul Laurie went on to win it, and it's one of the most famous Opens ever, so to be sat there watching that as like 9-10 years old is amazing.
You say your dad tried to qualify for the Open. Was he a golfer or?
No, just a very good amateur golfer, and he's unfortunately, well, he'd never changed anything in his past, but unfortunately he was very good at football as well and rugby, and he was, you know, a very social bloke, and he ended up with his fingers in a lot of pies rather than just focusing on the golf. And when I've seen a few, but I've never really spoken to my dad about this, but I've seen some footage of him hitting shots, and I've heard stories and bits and pieces. And by the sounds of what you hear, I think if he'd have dedicated himself to his golf, he probably had something similar to maybe what I've got. But he was good enough to have a go at Open qualifying every year, and he you could see that it was quite a sore one for him to miss. And just touching on that, like, he was so proud of me at the Open at Hoylake, and I got him. He was inside the ropes for the practice round, so we got on the third at Hoylake. I get confused with the holes at Hoylake because they change them round, don't they, for the Open? So mm-hmm. It was the fourth for the week of the Open, which is normally the second. And the pin was at the back, and there were loads of people around the green. It was only a practice day, and my dad was walking. I said, "Come here!" I was standing at the front of the green. What would you want? I said, just come up here. So he came up. I said, "This is pretty quick. This putt down here, isn't it?" He said, yeah, but your ball wouldn't stop here. And he didn't clock what I was doing. There were two balls on the ground. I rolled the ball down to about 6 foot. And I looked at him, I said, nearest the pin. He said, I can't do that. How can I? It's the Open. I can't. They'll throw me off the course. I said, Dad, come on. They're not going to throw me off the course, are they? I said, I might throw you off the course for the day. They're not going to, they're not, you know, come on, it's one putt, come on. So he goes, oh, like this. And you could see in gold jangling that he was about to hit a shot on an Open course. And he rolled it down, and it just grazed the edge of the hole and went to a couple of foot. The crowd went wild, obviously, for Dad. Go on, Dad. It was a lovely moment to see him. He was in his element, you know. He was only in a practice round, but seeing him walk down that green to pick the ball up just because he'd hit a shot on an Open course during the week of an Open. He was obviously not a tournament day, but it was brilliant. So as soon as he did it, I thought there and then, I've got to give him the badge. I've got to give him the player's badge. You've got to give him the badge that he never had. So I went round his on the couple of days after that Open, and I put the kettle on, and I said, I've got something for you. And he said, oh, what have you got for me? Like, obviously, he probably thought I had something for him for the Open. And your Open badge is amazing. It's special. There's something about getting your Open badge. It comes in a little navy blue sort of velvet bag, a little drawstring bag. And it's special to open that bag and have your player's badge. And I threw it at him across the kitchen table. And he was like, I can't take that. And I said, just take it. Like, you deserve it more than anyone. Like, you take it. I'll get another one. Like, don't worry about me. I'll get another one. And he's like, oh, okay. Then he's got it in his office. And obviously, lucky enough, I've got another two, which is nice. And I'll get another one this year, which is special. So that love affair with the Open, and that's the thing that brought. I've got a great bond with my dad, and we I think a lot of that's owed to definitely the game of golf, but certainly the Open Championship as well.
So Carnoustie itself, will that make it even more special?
Yeah, definitely. And I try and do this thing in my mind where I try and imagine things that are going to happen, and then I play it through in my mind. So like playing with Rory, I obviously knew that was going to be pretty daunting, so I played that first tee shot through in my mind 100 times. Rory's going to walk on the tee, I'm going to shake his hand, I'm going to give him the card, he's going to give me his card, I'm going to say hello to JP, his caddy. then I'm going to put the ball on the tee. And I play that through over and over again. And then on the Saturday of that, it almost happened exactly how I'd imagined because I got to the tee first. So I took control. Rory walked on the tee. Hi, Rory, I'm Matt. Through we went, this process. So because I'd already done it in my mind 100 times, I was sort of ready to do it for real. And I've already started to that process of what that Thursday is going to be like, because being a member of that golf club, I mean, that whole town is golf crazy. I mean, you've never seen anything like it. It doesn't matter whether you're a lawyer or you're signing on the dole. If you're a golfer and you love the game and you play the game with a true spirit, you're one of the boys. You're a proper person. And golf in that town bonds that town together, and they will be there in force on that first tee to support me. Just obviously where I'm a member of the club, which is going to be lovely, but it's going to be tough to take on as well, because there's going to be a lot of people in that crowd that have shot some seriously good scores around Carnoustie, and they're going to have a lot more knowledge of the course than me. Although I know the place inside out, there's guys up there that regularly shoot in the 60s, and they know every inch of the golf course. So it's going to be pretty tough to sort of fly the flag for them. And I'm kind of gearing myself up to be ready for that task, and hopefully the influence that the Irish crowd have on me in the Irish Open will be similar for the Open this year.
After hearing that, you've got to think Matt will be amongst the contenders at this year's Open. There was a couple of times in that interview when Matt's eyes went red, tears welling up. To go from cancer and his hospital bed to completing 14 rounds at three stages of Q School in just a matter of months shows his incredible strength and determination. His adversity, it appears, has only made him stronger, and it would be no surprise to see some of that translate soon into European Tour success. Next week on The Round, SSP Chaurasia, from the staff headquarters of Royal Kolkata Golf Club to winner of his national title.
Suddenly after third round, I'm leading the tournament, so it's I'm excitement. I was the Saturday night, I was talking to my wife because she was there. I say, I'm leading by 2 shot and tomorrow is final round. I have a big pressure, what I'll do now. He said, just come down and play your game. Doesn't matter. It's happened, whatever has happened, it's happened. Just you enjoy and playing your game. I say, yeah, you're right. You can say very easily, but it's tough. So, and the next day, the same thing I'm following. I'm just enjoying my days, and finally I win the tournament.
How the son of a greenkeeper became a four-time European Tour winner. The story of how talent and incredible will saw SSP defy the odds. How Chaurasia almost didn't get past his first few events as a pro to now playing into a third decade in a game that has changed his life.
Thank you for listening to The Round with Richard Kaufman. You can follow us and get in touch via Twitter at The Round Podcast, on Instagram, Podcast The Round, and on Facebook at The Round Richard Kaufman. And we'd appreciate you taking the time to rate and review us on iTunes. The Round Podcast with Richard Kaufman, in association with IMG Audio.